Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. What is today's topic?
Hi, Steve. We've got a couple of updates, and the focus today is going to be the first of a series that we're starting that will look at our planets in our solar system. Now, it's true that every planet must by definition orbit a sun. But after that, there's a tremendous variety, and that's what we're going to be exploring. And we're going to start this series by taking a closer look at Venus, often known as the morning star, the evening star, or even Earth's twin. So first off, Steve, let's hear about those updates.
Well, as mentioned in a previous episode, the European Space Agency is about to launch its JUICE mission, an acronym for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. And the JUICE probe will take, if you can believe this, 8 years to reach Jupiter. And when it does arrive in 2031, we'll spend 3.5 years orbiting Jupiter and conducting flybys of three of its moons, namely Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. Toward the ends of the mission, JUICE will focus solely on orbiting Ganymede, making it the first spacecraft to ever orbit a moon in the outer solar system. And my second update deals with the well-known binary star system called Hercules X1, which consists of a neutron star pulsar and its smaller companion star. Astronomers have just determined that the immense gravity of the neutron star is sucking material from the smaller star at velocities in excess of 450 kilometers per second. Or if you will, that's 1,600,000 kilometers per hour. And in doing so, the neutron star is sending out massive X-ray emissions. And since the star rotates at the incredible rate of once every second and a half, this makes it pulsate like a rapidly spinning flashlight, hence the term pulsar.
Just going to repeat that. This is a star that rotates every 1.5 seconds. But we're going to get on to our topic today about Venus. And I've got a question for you, Steve. Now, we know that Venus orbits closer to the sun than our own planet, but relatively speaking, Venus and Earth have quite a bit in common. We have similar orbits. Planets are of similar size, both rocky, both have environments. How is it that we only talk about sending humans to Mars, and how did Venus become so different than our own planet?
Donning my 10-year-old hat, Tim, I would say that you don't want to go to Venus because it's too close to the sun and your spaceship is going to get too hot. However, on the other hand, Venus is closer than Mars is, so that's a good question. So let's suppose you did have a rocket ship and you landed on Venus, and you, of course, would have to be able to return. And now we're talking about escape velocities. Now, escape velocity is the term describing the minimum speed an object must achieve in order to escape the gravitational pull of that planet.
Let's say we're talking about leaving Earth. Your rocket ship must be traveling at a speed of 11.2 kilometers per second, or 40,300 kilometers per hour. And that, of course, requires an enormous powerful engine and a lot of fuel. For example, if you think of the Apollo Saturn V rocket, it had seven massive engines and a tremendous amount of fuel to reach its escape velocity. When the Apollo lander left the moon, by contrast, it only needed to reach a speed of 2.4 kilometers per second and was using just one small rocket engine and a relatively small amount of fuel. Now, both Venus and Mars are less massive than the Earth, and so their escape velocities are less, being 37,300 kilometers per hour and 18,000 kilometers, respectively, for Mars. So it's twice as easy to leave Mars than Venus.
Well, that covers the mechanics of leaving either Venus or Mars. But now let's consider what happens after you land, you open up the hatch, and what greets you?
In terms of the atmosphere, Steve, that's where everything changes. First of all, you'll be greeted by an enormous pressure of 90 atmospheres. Now, this is a relative term, as we live under one pressure. To get an idea of the increased pressure we're talking about here, consider what happens when you go diving. Water pressure increases one atmosphere every 10 meters of depth. The typical deep end of a swimming pool is perhaps 5 meters, and we all know what that feels like, swimming to the bottom of a swimming pool. Imagine the pressure under 1 kilometer of water. That's what's going to hit your entire body on Venus.
And the next thing, you'd be blasted by 475 degrees Celsius of heat, five times that of boiling water. And that's partially due to the planet's extremely slow rotational period. Each day on Venus is 116 Earth days long. Or in other words, you wake up in the morning and the sun doesn't set for 116 days. And the other reason for the extreme heat is its atmosphere is composed mainly of carbon dioxide with clouds of sulfuric acid, which have created a runaway greenhouse effect, trapping heat and causing the extreme temperatures on the planet's surface.
You know, for a place named after a Roman goddess of love, Venus certainly doesn't sound like a destination resort. Now, you mentioned the greenhouse effect, and we know that there's too much carbon dioxide in our atmosphere these days, but not on Venus's scale. Is there an understanding of why there is such a difference, Steve?
Earth's tectonic plates play a critical role in removing carbon dioxide by taking it from the atmosphere and storing it in the Earth's crust or ocean floor in a process called carbon sequestration. With the sliding of tectonic plates one under another, carbon is buried in sedimentary rocks and the ocean floor. Carbon is returned to the atmosphere through volcanic activity, but this process is relatively slow, taking millions of years, allowing the carbon cycle to remain balanced. In contrast, Venus doesn't have plate tectonics, and its surface is dominated by volcanic activity.
Yeah, I get that. The carbon dioxide in the Venusian atmosphere isn't removed, but is continuously recycled through volcanic activity, and that results in this thick, heat-trapping atmosphere, producing surface levels hot enough to melt lead. So much for opening the hatch and trying to live on Venus. But just how did we learn of this physical characteristic if we haven't sent people there?
Well, we have to thank the space race for that, Tim. So while the Soviets actually beat the Americans in first getting to the moon with various probes, it soon became apparent that the Americans were going to beat them in placing a man on the moon, and so they focused their energies on going to Venus. Now, Tim, we all know what American launch countdowns sound like. For comparative purposes, let's listen to a Russian launch manager calling out a typical countdown in Russian. The Soviet Venera missions, Venera being Russian for Venus, began in 1961 and ran through to 1985. Though Venera 1 and 2 failed en route, Venera 3 in 1965 did manage to crash land, though no data was transmitted. In 1967, Venera 4 was somewhat more successful in that it descended via parachute and did transmit atmospheric data before imploding. Now that's imploding, not exploding. It imploded because of the tremendous pressures.
Building upon gained atmospheric knowledge, Venera 5 and 6 were built stronger. And in 1969, the year the Americans landed on the moon, they sent back atmospheric data. In 1970, Venera 7 successfully landed on Venus and sent back data indicating an atmospheric pressure and composition. And the surprising fact that surface winds are calm, about 2 meters per second, half of the Earth's average of 4 meters per second.
The 1975 launch of Venera 9 and 10 proved to be a landmark mission because they were the first spacecraft to transmit images of the Venusian surface. But it's here, Tim, that the Russians experienced a systemic engineering failure, not unlike Chevrolet's Corvair car, as exposed by Ralph Nader, and detailed in his 1965 expose, Unsafe at Any Speed. The Soviets had persistent problems with removing Venera camera lens caps, which protected the delicate instruments during their hellish descent. Once safely on the surface, the curved metal lenses were supposed to be jettisoned by detonating a small explosive charge. One failed to deploy on Venera 9, leaving only one camera operable, and the same thing happened on Venera 10.
Okay, let me guess, Steve. Both camera lens failed on Venera 11 and 12?
Oh, yes. And as our old friend Ron Popeil used to say, but wait, there's more. In addition to cameras, Venera 14 carried a microphone and a drill to probe Venus's surface. When the probe landed, one lens cap failed to eject, but the other produced marvelous color photos. However, the Venera 14 craft had the misfortune of ejecting that camera lens directly under the surface compressibility drilling tester arm, which furtively tried to drill through the metal, and it thus rendering the experiment as a failure.
It's incredible. Now, I think, Steve, you've found the Venera 14 microphone recording of Venus's atmosphere, the sound of the lens cap being blown off, and the drill trying its darndest to get a core sample of Venus, but instead testing good old Russian steel. Let's have a listen. We covered off the amazing history of Russian, or if you will, the Soviet Union missions to Venus. And it would make some sense now to talk about NASA's own plans to return to Venus in 2027 with its Veritas mission. Now, by the way, that catchy name was conjured up with some finesse, and it stands for the Venus Emissivity Radio Science InSAR Topography and Spectroscopy. And that's the truth.
Those scientists will never miss an opportunity for a catchy acronym. And that just reminded me, Veritas is the tool-making section of Lee Valley Instruments in Ottawa. Oh, well, I digress.
One of my favorite stores. Is that a shameless plug? I hope they give me a gift. So due to budget and staffing constraints, the most recent budget proposed by President Biden would see the mission drop, the Veritas mission drop from NASA's plans, or at a minimum, put on some kind of life support. However, just a few days ago, a public campaign was launched by the redoubtable Planetary Society to save the project. A key part of this mission, the Veritas mission, was to focus on something we talked about before the break, and that's the reason why the tectonic plates on Earth are so different from those on Venus. There's a strong link between movement of these plates and the greenhouse effect of carbon stored in the atmosphere. And here's a quote from the Planetary Society's letter to Congress published just a few days ago. Quote, "Without Veritas, the United States will miss an extraordinary opportunity to lead the vanguard of scientific exploration of Venus, including how its planet and surface changed from a habitable to uninhabitable environment." So that's hopefully a letter that will make some difference. And we've spoken quite a bit about the human efforts to explore with the spacecraft in Venus, but there's plenty more to cover off when we consider Venus. Venus might have been named after a Roman goddess, but that had me wondering about how our nearest neighbor had made out by religious scholars. And indeed, there are plenty of biblical references, starting with one that's a bit surprising, actually, for a goddess. In the King James Version of the Christian Bible, Venus is often referred to as Lucifer, which, of course, we typically associate with the devil. But as it turns out, Lucifer meant light bearer in Latin. There are other references to Venus in the Bible, including in the book of Job, where it is referred to as the, quote, morning star and, quote, the evening star. So overall, the references to Venus in the Bible are actually few in number, and they're just widely debated and as to their meaning and significance. Now, not being religious myself, I'd have to say this is all somewhat surprising. We are talking about the third brightest object in the sky after the moon and the sun.
Well, Venus may not have featured prominently in the Bible, but it does in other cultures. Now, for instance, in the Babylonian mythology, the planet is associated with the goddess Ishtar, who was the goddess of love, fertility, and war. And that's a dichotomy if ever there was one. In Mayan mythology, the planet was associated with Quetzalcoatl, who was the god of wind, wisdom, and agricultural abundance. In Hindu mythology, Venus is one of the nine celestial gods and is known as Shukra, the goddess of love, beauty, and wealth.
So there's the biblical side of things, but setting that aside, sailors used the positions of the stars, such as Polaris, the North Star, to navigate at sea, as well as the planets, Jupiter and Mars, but especially Venus, as its position just before sunrise or just after sunset could be used to determine east or west direction. Mars, on the other hand, is a reddish-orange planet that is often visible in the night sky, particularly when it is at its closest approach to Earth. Its position in the sky can be used to determine the ship's longitude as well as the time of day. Other planets such as Jupiter and Saturn can also be used for navigation, and they were, but are generally less useful than Venus and Mars due to their position in the sky and their relative brightness.
You know, Tim, given the ubiquitous nature of navigation by GPS today, I suspect future generations will consider the science of celestial navigation to be obsolete. But I hasten to mention that during the Apollo missions to the moon, they did rely upon verifying their flight path by aligning the stellar positions of Canopus, Sirius, and Procyon, extremely bright stars, dare I say, unknown by the vast majority of people today.
Okay, we've taken a quick look at biblical references, and you've referenced the planet's role in navigation. We can jump forward a little bit in time and take a peek at the place of the second planet from the sun in literature and the silver screen. Venus, with its unique characteristics and mysterious nature, has captured the imagination of filmmakers and writers for decades. So let's dive in to the pop culture of Venus. It's been a popular setting in sci-fi movies and literature. One of the most famous movies featuring Venus is called Forbidden Planet, released in 1956. This iconic sci-fi film portrays a mission to the distant planet, which is later revealed to be Venus. The movie showcases a mysterious alien civilization and the challenges faced by the humans, the human explorers, that is, on the planet. And there's a couple of fun aspects to that particular movie that I wanted to mention. It was the first movie to have a faster-than-light spacecraft, and one of the stars was one of the great all-time comedic actors, Leslie Nielsen. And who can forget another first, Robbie the Robot, a robot with personality.
I think you skipped ahead a bit too far, Tim. What about 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still? Now, we've previously mentioned this classic movie and its hero, Klaatu, said to come from the planet Venus, and his kind were depicted as being advanced human beings who had achieved peace and enlightenment. However, this does bring to mind a movie about Earthlings traveling to Venus, and who else but the Three Stooges could manage to inadvertently bumble their way into a spaceship. Let's have a listen to how Hollywood depicted their antics from the 1959 movie, Half Rocket Will Travel.
Stars beyond number, time without end. The universe stretches, mysterious, unknown, demanding it be explored. Great institutions, mighty space vehicles, brilliant men and women. The building and firing of a machine designed to carry man into space requires an organization of many men and women, many minds, many talents. Some, it may seem at first glance, in lowly but necessary positions.
I am Larry.
I am Mo.
And I am Curly Joe. Take us to your leader.
The race for space has just begun. The race to reach the moon and sun. And we've got half the battle won. Half rocket. Oh, we'll travel. Let's prepare the launching pad, I say. Half rocket. We'll travel away.
Venus has often been portrayed as a planet with a hostile environment in sci-fi, and its scorching temperatures, acidic clouds, and thick atmosphere are obviously dramatic effects. For instance, in 2018, the movie The First Purge, it featured Venus as a potential new habitable planet for humans to escape the overpopulated and chaotic Earth. This movie depicts Venus as a refuge, a possible refuge for humanity, despite the challenges posed by its extreme conditions. What with the price of housing in Vancouver, Steve, who knows, maybe that's still an option.
Venus has also been a prominent theme in literature. Many authors have drawn inspiration from Venus to create compelling stories. For example, in Ray Bradbury's classic science fiction novel, The Martian Chronicles, Venus is depicted as a planet covered in vast oceans and jungles, inhabited by strange and mysterious creatures. The novel explores the human colonization of Venus and the challenges faced by the settlers in this new and hostile environment. And then again, there's the 1958 film Queen of Outer Space. Venus is portrayed as a lush tropical planet with a breathable atmosphere, inhabited by beautiful human-like women. And though not scientifically accurate, the movie showcases the popular imagination of Venus as an exotic and alluring world.
And now the story of the fantastic adventure that befalls mankind's most daring crew of space explorers.
A sound, not even the hum of an insect. Is this a dead planet?
Landing on an unknown planet, they are captured by long-limbed beauties. When they say, take me to your leader, and they take them to a creature like this, you know they're on planet Venus. And the queen of outer space is Zsa Zsa Gabor. The most talked about woman in the world knows what she wants on Venus, too.
Venus has also been featured in romantic literature, often associated with its mesmerizing beauty as the evening star or morning star. In mythology, Venus was the Roman goddess of love and beauty, and this association is carried over into the literature too. Many romantic novels and poems reference Venus as a symbol of love and passion, evoking images of a mystical and enchanting planet. Well, some say romance can't last forever, and we're not leaving Venus without jumping to 2009 and the film Avatar. Venus, in this movie, is a harsh, uninhabitable planet with a toxic atmosphere and extreme weather conditions. This portrayal, of course, aligns more closely with the scientific understanding of Venus as a hostile planet where temperatures can melt lead and atmospheric pressure is crushing.
Venus has also been featured in numerous other science fiction movies, such as The Day the Earth Caught Fire and Space Cowboys and 1953's Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. Yes, they end up going the wrong way. They end up in Venus.
A bad call on their part. So Venus has been a popular topic in poetry, music, and art. Artists and poets have often used Venus as a muse, depicting its alluring appearance in the sky and drawing inspiration from its mythological significance. And Venus has been associated quite often with femininity, beauty, and sensuality. From sci-fi movies to romantic literature, Venus has been portrayed in diverse ways, ranging from a harsh and inhospitable planet to a mystical and alluring celestial body. In literature, Venus has been a source of inspiration too for science fiction writers as well as poets and authors. For example, in the classic science fiction novel, Paralandra by C.S. Lewis, Venus is portrayed as a lush and Edenic world inhabited by extraterrestrial creatures and featuring a battle between good and evil.
And Venus has been featured in other literary works, such as Ray Bradbury's The Long Rain, where Venus is depicted as a relentless and unforgiving planet with never-ending rainstorms. In Arthur C. Clarke's The Sands of Mars, Venus is imagined as a terraformed and habitable world where humans have established colonies. I don't know that it's particular insight on my part here, Tim, but in sum, I'd say that the weather on Venus has been hard to pin down when it comes to its place in movies, literature, and art. You know what they say, if you don't like the weather on Venus, just wait another 20 minutes. And, you know, Tim, with regard to talking about movies, so many of these movies can be found on YouTube. All you have to do is type in such gems such as Abbott and Costello Go to Mars or Have Rocket Will Travel, and you will find them. And it's interesting to take a look at the technology and how they imagine things to be. As I say, the things that you and I have found while researching these topics just astound me to no end.
And that's just the first of the planets that we've taken a look at. So we've got lots more coming up. That's all the time we have today, though, for Space Talks. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we did in our usual research. So until next time, when our topic will be space tourism, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.